Welcome back to Podcast 2 as part of our series of podcasts on the diagnosis and management of early inflammatory arthritis. My name is Daniel Murphy. I am the RCGP and British Society for Rheumatology Clinical Champion for Inflammatory Arthritis. So we're here today to raise the profile of inflammatory arthritis, to talk about how GPs can help manage patients with inflammatory arthritis, how we can improve symptoms, improve management, and improve outcomes for the patients that we look after. I'm here today with Richard Haig, a consultant colleague from the Royal Devon Exeter Hospital, with Jane Ely, who's a patient who's very kindly helping us today to talk through the patient's perspective of inflammatory arthritis, and with Jill Moran, our senior nurse specialist. So in our first podcast, we talked about early diagnosis, how and why that's really important, how early diagnosis can help patients, and the really profound effect that a diagnosis of inflammatory arthritis can have on a patient's life. In our second podcast, we're going to look much more at chronic management. When a patient's been diagnosed, how can GPs help support patients? What does the GP need to know about DMARDs, management of flares, and how our fantastic specialist nurses can help support patients through their journey? So, Jane, you've very eloquently described in our first podcast about how your arthritis came on, the symptoms it caused you, and the effect it's had on your life and work. You described how you came into hospital and were diagnosed. I was just wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about the specialist nursing team and how they've helped you manage your arthritis.
It's very reassuring to be able to phone up the team and be able to ask any, even if it's a small question, something that, you know, has happened or something that is different every day, or should I be worried about this? Do I need to come in and see you? And to have that point of contact at the end of a phone is just excellent.
Yeah. So in Exeter, we have a helpline, don't we, with an answer phone where our nurses will always call you back within a working day.
Yeah.
I know when you were diagnosed with rheumatoid, you spoke to some of our nursing team about the drugs and the drugs that we were going to start.
Yes, I was concerned about in which order to take them, and initially, especially when you're on steroids and then on methotrexate, and I had quite a list of drugs to take, and I just wanted to be sure I was doing it the right way. So so they're a phone call away, which is excellent.
Yeah. So Jill, I'm going to turn to you. I think nurse specialists are a fantastic bridge between the patient, between rheumatologists, between GPs. I think they're a key hub, really, in the management of inflammatory arthritis. I think a lot of GPs won't necessarily have come across a rheumatology specialist nurse in the line of work. Could you tell us a little bit about your role?
So one of the things we do, is, as you say, is we're a point of contact, really, for patients, but also for the GPs that are helping to manage the patients. And our role involves educating patients at the beginning when they're newly diagnosed. So, what an autoimmune disorder is, how it can best be managed, and what the expectation is going forward about what they can see happening either with their work or their health.
Mm-hmm.
So we see patients face-to-face in clinic to talk about the DMARDs that they've been prescribed, and we'll talk about the rationale behind why we're giving them the medication that they're being given, how they can take it safely,
mm-hmm.
What to expect from the medication, because they often take quite a while to work, and how to manage their condition whilst we're waiting for those drugs to start to be effective for them.
Sure. So you're really key at diagnosis and explaining about disease and about treatment and what patients can expect. What about later on in their disease course? What types of interactions do you have with patients?
So we go on seeing patients on a regular basis, in clinic face-to-face, but also on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
So we do work to monitor them alongside our consultants to make sure that the drugs remain effective and aren't causing any problems for them. And we continue to offer education to the patients so that they can really work to manage their own conditions themselves. And that involves explaining how the condition can fluctuate. So they can get flares in their condition where things get worse again for short periods of time, and that there are things they can do to manage those flares. Mm-hmm. So that the patient remains in control of things, even when they're not on their best days.
Yeah, so this is about empowering and encouraging patients really to help look after their own disease and self-manage.
Yes.
Brilliant. And I know that you do a huge amount of work with the helpline and responding to calls from patients and GPs. What types of problems do patients tend to call into the helpline about?
About 50% of our work is actually done on the telephone, responding to people who have questions or problems. And probably the biggest issue that people phone in is with flares, where they feel that they have got worse, where they're dealing with a sudden onset of pain, where their joints have swollen up, where they're suddenly finding fatigue has come back again. And sometimes it's about reassuring them that this is a natural part of the process, and it does happen from time to time, and that with appropriate rest and pacing and analgesia, it normally settles down again relatively quickly, and that they can manage these things without having to either come into hospital or see their GP, and that it becomes a part of their self-management.
Okay. And Jane, have you found that helpful, that advice and source of support from our nursing team?
Yes, incredibly. Yes, because you don't know what to expect. And especially when you're newly diagnosed, it's all brand new information.
Okay.
And it can be scary.
Yeah. So, Jill, if you were to think about how you and our nursing team can help our GPs manage inflammatory arthritis, what types of support can you provide for GPs?
I think we also can offer the same kinds of advice to GPs who might be unsure about whether or not a patient experiencing a flare is something that can be managed without being seen again very quickly. Mm-hmm. We can give advice directly to the GPs. Having spoken to GPs, we often directly phone the patients and speak to them to give advice and education. And if things have got worse, we can often then come through and speak to one of our consultants and say, actually, we think this is something that needs to be seen sooner or have further tests done. So we kind of signpost to GPs about when things can be managed out in the community and when we can see patients sooner to try and get on top of things that have become more serious.
So it sounds like you're very much you're the hub at the centre of that wheel, that you're helping field queries and questions from patients and GPs.
Yes.
Feedback to consultants and really trying to help the holistic management.
So there's a centre of communication, I think, there, that we can direct queries and problems in the right direction.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think communication is really key to what specialist nurses do.
Yes.
Brilliant. That brings on really nicely to flares, because you've talked a lot about flares in there. And said a lot of patient contacts are regarding flares. And I think that's something that patients will often present to GPs with. What types of symptoms do patients complain about to you when they describe a flare?
They describe an increase in pain, predominantly joint pain, but generalised pain as well. They definitely see an increase in their fatigue, which they can't put down to any particular thing. Their joints will become stiff and swollen, particularly in the mornings, and they can feel a bit unwell. They're not sure whether they've got a flu or whether something else is happening. And that can be quite frightening when that happens, particularly if you think you've got things under control, to suddenly find things not being quite right again can be very troublesome.
So when you're speaking to patients and they are describing those symptoms to you, tell me, how can patients start to manage those symptoms themselves? What can patients do to try and help control a flare?
It is a little bit dependent on the pattern that you see. So if patients are experiencing lots of flares very close together, the question is, can we say why? Have they changed the amount of activity they're undertaking? Are they particularly tired? Are they taking their medications as we think they are? So sometimes it's possible by talking through patterns to come up with reasons for the flare happening. And that allows changes to take place that can bring the flares back under control again. Sometimes, though, flares happen for absolutely no reason that we can work out at all. They can come out of nowhere, which I think often are the most worrying for patients. One of the things we try and do is say that this can happen for no particular reason, but equally with rest and with management, they can settle down again very quickly. So they don't necessarily mean that things are going wrong. They are part of the natural disease process, unfortunately, for some patients.
I think often giving yourself the permission to be kind to yourself and saying, look, I'm having a bad day, I'm having a flare. There are things today that I can put off to tomorrow. I'm just going to do that. And we often talk to patients about having a good day and a bad day plan, don't we?
Yes.
So that on a good day, you're aware of what you can do. Jane talked about going to the gym and running and being very active, and that's brilliant. And then, as you said, sometimes out of the blue, a flare can come along and can just make you feel not quite right. And giving yourself permission to slow down, to pace yourself, to say, I can put that off till tomorrow. I think often that can settle things down.
I think that's very important, and I think that takes a lot of the anxiety over managing flares and thinking that you have to be on your top game every day. And I think when we can, allowing families to understand that as well is very important, so that other people around the patient can also recognise it and help them to say, okay, this isn't such a good day. Let's allow you to rest so that you can become well again.
And Richard, thinking more medically about flares, we've heard from Jill about how patients can help self-manage. As a GP, what types of things do you think should be crossing GPs' minds when a patient presents with a flare?
Okay, and as Jill has rightly said, there are different types of flare. And I think sometimes flares can be triggered by a viral infection, a bacterial infection, may have an operation, you might have had an episode of diarrhoea and vomiting, you've missed your drugs for a couple of weeks. And then there's the random flare. So I think there are lots of different types of flare-ups and severity of flare-ups. I think if one flare-up runs into another flare-up, that's not flare-up. That is not a short-term loss of control that may be able to be self-managed. That is poor control of rheumatoid arthritis, and we don't tolerate that anymore. And we don't tolerate that anymore because persistent inflammation over time equals damage. And so I would certainly think, and we frequently get a call from a specialist nurse saying, I've now spoken to this patient, they've self-managed this flare, we've given a short course of steroid for this flare, and now they've had another one. That means they need to be seen in hospital and need to be either referred in by their GP, phone the advice line, or we need to do something about it. So I think it's very reasonable for a short-term flare for a GP to either administer analgesia, a short course of anti-inflammatories, or even a short course of prednisolone. And often a patient will tell you what does it for them. So I often say to a patient, especially an experienced patient, you've had this flare-up now, what does it for you? And they may say, well, actually, I take 20 milligrams for 4 or 5 days and I'm brilliant. And other patients will say, well, actually, the last time you did that for me, that didn't work, and I may have to give 40 milligrams for a couple of weeks and then tail off over another couple of weeks. So it's very individual. And sometimes a patient does know best about what to do in that situation, and I often follow that. So if someone says 20 milligrams works for me, that's what I'll do. But I think we don't tolerate persistent. You know, in the old days, we used to say, well, take an anti-inflammatory, rest a little bit more. But I think that attitude has gone now. And it's gone for a number of reasons. It's gone for we know that persistent inflammation causes damage and disability and work loss and difficulty looking after families. And we've also got some excellent treatments. We don't just have steroids anymore. We've got a whole bucket of disease modifying drugs. And after that, we've got many classes of biologic drugs. And new biologic drugs are coming on all the time. New really good aggressive treatments. So I think there's a lot of things we can do, and making sure the patients know that. Is important.
So you feel that if a GP is confident that a patient's having a flare of arthritis, given a short course of oral steroids, it's very reasonable management of primary care.
Absolutely reasonable, but I wouldn't want the third course or if the third course, I'd quite like a phone call, and Jill would quite like a phone call, and I'd hope by then our patient who's got our advice line details and a little sticker for the fridge and all that sort of stuff will have phoned us already.
So it's about that story and about that pattern that we're not seeing a generalised increase in activity. That's what we don't want to miss. Are there any red flags that would make you sit back and think, hang on, am I missing something here?
Yeah, well, rheumatoid is a systemic disease, and sometimes patients have systemic symptoms such as fevers and sweats. But I think if a patient has fevers and sweats and weight loss and other things, I would think of something else. Mm-hmm. So that's those generalised symptoms. And then if you think about the joints, a patient may have a polyarticular flare-up or they may have a monoarticular flare-up. And when one joint flares up in rheumatoid arthritis, we have a different differential diagnosis.
Yeah.
And septic arthritis has to be excluded. Mm-hmm. So rheumatoid itself predisposes to septic arthritis and is the commonest predisposing factor. And some of our disease-modifying drugs and steroids in particular do. Mm-hmm. So if a joint is red, it's very unusual to get a joint in rheumatoid arthritis whilst the patient's on treatment that's red. Mm-hmm. So a red hot joint means, I'm afraid, a needle has to be put into it.
Yeah.
So that's often a referral to secondary care.
Yeah.
So we don't mind if a GP phones us up and says, look, patient of mine's got a sore hot knee. It's a bit red. The patient feels unwell. We will act that day.
Yeah.
Sometimes it may be the orthopaedic service that acts. Sometimes it'll be the rheumatology service. Sometimes it'll be ED, depending on your locality.
Yeah.
We would see that patient that day or at the very least within 24 hours.
Yeah. So to summarise our management of flares, and they're common. Sometimes they can have a trigger, like infection. Sometimes they can come out of the blue.
Yep.
We've heard from Jill that patients can self-manage flares, sometimes very well, with pacing and with analgesia and with ice. Sometimes we do need pharmacological management. We do need to think about steroids. And we've heard from Richard that a short course of oral steroids is very reasonable. But we've also heard that there are some red flags that we should be aware of, that patients particularly who are on immunosuppressants, who are unwell with fevers and systemic symptoms, that should just prompt a little wave of a red flag that we should look in a little bit more detail. And also we've heard about monoarthritis, that we have to exclude a septic arthritis if somebody has a very red, hot, swollen single joint. So the other aspect of chronic disease management that is often raised by patients, and that the National Rheumatoid Arthritis Society specifically has asked me to talk about, is access to disease-modifying drugs. Disease-modifying drugs in inflammatory arthritis are usually started in secondary care. They're usually started by a rheumatologist, but often their prescribing is taken on by GPs in primary care. Patients sometimes can find access to disease-modifying drugs difficult and blood testing, and there have been some changes recently in the national guidance about disease-modifying drugs and about the monitoring frequency. So we're going to talk a little bit about those. So, Richard, the new BSR, British Society for Rheumatology guidelines, recently come out that oversees the prescribing and monitoring of disease-modifying drugs. Very briefly, could you summarise some of the key changes for us?
What they've done really nicely and succinctly is set out some screening tests we need to do in all of our patients, and they've rationalised those, so they're very simple and straightforward. And essentially, there's a very similar batch for all of our disease-modifying drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically a clinical history and some blood tests.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty straightforward, and that is done in secondary care, and that is our responsibility. It's not primary care's responsibility to do that. And then all patients should be counselled about a disease-modifying drug, either by a doctor with specialist knowledge in rheumatology or a specialist nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that is clearly our responsibility.
Yep.
Arrangements will differ around the country, but as you say, often they're prescribed and monitored in primary care, but with reference to the secondary care team.
Mm-hmm.
And the changes are mainly that once patients have been stable on a number of drugs, instead of religiously going on with monthly blood tests, which are often completely normal, some of the recommendations have been that they can be relaxed.
Yeah.
And people are often very fearful of methotrexate. It's often safer to be on methotrexate than isn't on a non-steroidal.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that if your patient is at low risk, so they've not got multiple comorbidities and their renal function is normal and they haven't had major trouble with methotrexate in the past, the monitoring can be relaxed to doing a blood test every 3 months.
Brilliant.
For sulfasalazine, once the initial monitoring period is over, the recommendation is you don't need to do any more. And that's because if you have not had a drug-induced hepatitis early on, you're highly unlikely ever to have it with sulfasalazine. And the incidence of neutropenias long-term is one in about 10,000.
Yeah.
So there is no point in doing blood monitoring trying to look for that patient.
Yep.
So there are some recommendations that have been really helpful for us to clarify and to be and to put formally the relaxation of monitoring guidelines. Yep. And that reassures us because we've been doing it for a while, and it reassures general practitioners that it's a good and it's a standard and well nationally recommended thing to do, and it's good for patients because you don't have to keep coming out of work or having another needle every month.
Yeah. So broadly, the guidelines are very reassuring. They tell us that DMARDs are safe and that we can monitor patients' blood tests much less frequently, which is good for GPs and good for resource management and good for patients. But we do sometimes see problems with DMARDs and DMARD blood tests. And a question that I'm often asked by colleagues is, what do I do with this abnormal result? And I guess that's a question that often comes up on the helpline, isn't it, Jill?
So
could you give us some advice about what we should do if we see, let's say, an abnormal ALT result on somebody's monitoring blood tests?
Well, it will depend a little bit on how abnormal it is.
Mm-hmm.
Is it three times normal or is it only slightly elevated?
Yeah.
And is there a pattern in it? So has it been going up blood test on blood test for the last 4 months? Or is this a one-off spurious test? And very often I will speak to a patient to try and determine whether or not anything has changed that can explain the blood test, whether they've been ill, whether they have changed their habits recently. And we would ask the patient to get a repeat test, usually in 2 weeks, so that we can continue to see the pattern.
Yeah.
If it is more than three times normal, we would normally stop the drug as a precaution and repeat the blood test and check that it's coming back into normal limits.
So I think the key thing there, as with all of our blood tests, is it's the trend.
Yes.
So an ALT, to take that example, that's been steadily climbing and is continuing to climb, would be more of a worry than an isolated reading of that's just slightly above the upper limit of normal.
Yes.
OK, Richard.
And the commonest cause of a raised ALT in many patients is BMI.
Yeah.
You know, we commonly have patients with non-alcoholic steatohepatosis that run a slightly grumbling ALT.
Yeah.
And we're pressured into taking them off methotrexate. We take them off methotrexate, and for the next year, they continue to have a grumbling ALT.
Yeah.
So we often find on drug cessation for some of those sort of minor abnormalities of blood test, actually withdrawal of drug only causes a flare-up.
Yeah.
And we really should be holding tight and staying on a drug.
Yeah.
One of the other things to pick up on is that trends in falling neutrophil and lymphocyte counts, I think... if a patient's not having infection and there's a 0.1 below the normal range, I think we can sit tight.
Yeah.
I think if you have a constantly dropping neutrophil count and another clue is a blip in the MCV, I mean, that could be impending bone marrow suppression.
Yeah.
And I think that would be well worth stopping, withdrawing the drug, doing another blood test and asking for advice.
Yeah. And I think I'd say that in general, rheumatologists are quite friendly people. You know, We like talking about patients. We like talking about disease. So
we would always much rather have a phone call or an email or a query than find out that a patient's been off a drug for 4 months and flared, or vice versa, a patient's come to harm and the drug hasn't been stopped.
Yeah. And are there any specifics that you'd like to raise about DMARDs? Anything that crops up frequently that you'd ask GPs to consider?
I think we picked the two. I think you picked ALT, which is a common one, and I picked the full blood count. Rheumatoid arthritis is often associated with the anemia of chronic disease, and methotrexate is often blamed on that. And actually, if a patient has poor control, paradoxically, more methotrexate will cause an increase in their hemoglobin and make the patient feel better rather than less. So that's one thing that's important. And I think sometimes drug interactions are important.
Yeah.
And I think the one with methotrexate is if a patient of yours has a urinary tract infection and you want to put them on trimethoprim or septrin, There's an interaction there, and especially in elderly patients with poor renal function, that can be a really big problem, and that can cause pancytopenia and bone marrow failure. So that's something to think about. On the computers in general practice, that should flash an angry message at you saying don't prescribe it. In some areas of the country, some drugs are prescribed from secondary care. Some methotrexate is, some subcutaneous methotrexate is. Mm-hmm. So we should always make sure that the GP is aware the patient is on this drug.
Yeah.
And we specifically ask our GPs to please add this to your practice computer list.
Yeah.
So the machine does flash up and give you an angry message if you want to co-prescribe methotrexate and trimethoprim, stroke Ceftriaxone.
Computer says no.
Yeah.
So that leads on nicely into the last part of our podcast, which is thinking about the annual inflammatory arthritis review. So, as part of QOF, GPs are required to invite patients in for an annual review when they're diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. It's an important part of management of rheumatoid. So whilst we wouldn't necessarily expect GPs to offer a full rheumatology review and examine everybody's joints, I think there are some really important parts of the annual review to pick up, aren't there, that we can really help holistically manage somebody's rheumatoid. Thinking about the annual review, Richard, are there any features that you think are really important that GPs should be focusing on?
I think what GPs are good at are spotting when things are going wrong, and they know their patients very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as part of the annual review, although I wouldn't expect a DASCAL, I would certainly expect some assessment of whether the joint disease is going well or not, or whether there have been lots of flares. Some patients are very stoic and they don't like phoning the helpline and they don't like calling their GP. So actually an annual review, and a GP may discover that there's poor control of disease and there's lots of swollen joints and the patient limps into the room, well, that's an encouragement to get in contact with our service. So I think, although I wouldn't expect a DAS score, some idea about what's been going on is very, very useful. And then again, what GPs are good at, they're good at risk assessment and thinking about cardiovascular disease. And you know, not a lot of people have realised that rheumatoid arthritis has the same risk as type 2 diabetes for cardiovascular disease. And when you're going to put a patient's data into Q-risk, when the score comes out, you should multiply it by 1.5.
Mm-hmm.
There are some scores that include rheumatoid arthritis.
Q-risk 2 now involves rheumatoid arthritis.
It does involve it. So that's really important.
Brilliant. Jill, when we think about annual reviews, there are some other parts of patients' lifestyle that we can think about. Smoking in particular is something that we're keen to try and help patients with rheumatoid stop. Could you explain a little bit about why that's the case?
Yes, one of the things we now know about patients who continue to smoke after diagnoses is that they are more likely to have an aggressive form of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that if they are able to stop using tobacco, that risk factor drops.
Mm-hmm.
So they are less likely to have an aggressive form of the disease. We also know that they respond better to the DMARD medication if they stop smoking.
Yeah.
So they can help themselves if they are able to reduce or ideally stop using tobacco.
Yeah.
And we do talk to them about this. We explain the risks. It's something that many patients are completely unaware of. It's not something that gets a lot of airtime. And we can talk to them about how they can go about trying to reduce or stop their smoking.
So alongside the secondary health benefits of reduced cardiovascular risks and reduced risk of lung disease, we do see that smokers have more aggressive arthritis.
Yes.
Okay. So we've talked a little bit about smoking and about cardiovascular risk. I think bone health and fracture prevention is really important, thinking about a FRAC score and whether patients should be offered a DEXA scan. We heard really eloquently from Jane earlier about the psychological impact of arthritis and the impact it can have on a patient's life. I think depression screening is a really important part of the annual review.
I think it's very important. I think these are both common conditions, but there is patients with rheumatoid arthritis have a lot more depression.
Mm-hmm.
We know there are theories of the etiology of depression now that talk about inflammation. And so there are shared risk factors for depression and rheumatoid arthritis. And we know that patients with depression have reduced function, have more work loss, and don't cope with their disease as well. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really, really important.
Brilliant. So, summarising then our series of podcasts, I think we've talked a lot about the specialist nurse as the hub of a centre of patients' wheel, but actually I think the true hub, really, in managing a patient's arthritis is their GP. We heard from Jane how her GP was fantastic in referring early and getting her to the right clinician to treat her disease really quickly. We've talked a lot in our second podcast about how GPs can help manage a patient's DMARDs and prescribing, how they can help manage flares, how in concert with our specialist nurses, they can get access to a very rapid source of expert help. And we've also heard about the annual rheumatoid arthritis review, how holistic healthcare is really important in rheumatoid, thinking about cardiovascular risk, thinking about fracture risk, thinking about mental health. Jane, I'm going to come back to you to close. We talked a little bit about the end of our first podcast, but I just wondered if we could repeat that again if people have missed it. If there's a patient out there who's listening to this podcast thinking, "Blimey, that sounds like that might be me. My rheumatoid might not be well controlled. I might have new rheumatoid. I might be struggling with my drugs." But what might you say to patients?
Go and see your GP. Talk to your rheumatology team. Because, again, if they're on the end of the phone, then you can get hold of them and any little worries or niggles, you know, the answer's at the end of the phone.
Brilliant.
So,
thank you. And thank you so much for coming and talking to us today.
No, you're welcome.
Thank you to Richard. Thank you to Jill. For anybody else who has any questions or queries, there are lots of help and support out there. So for GPs and patients who would like more information about inflammatory arthritis, the Royal College of GPs Inflammatory Arthritis Toolkit is available online. Search via your favourite search engine and it will come up as the first link. There's a wealth of information there about early diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, the different types of arthritis that we see, and the long-term management, both DMARDs and cardiovascular risk. We have some hugely supportive patient organisations who can help support patients who need more information or support. Arthritis Research UK have a huge library of patient information via their website. The National Rheumatoid Arthritis Society and the National Ankylosing Spondylitis Society offer both patient helplines and specific advice via their website. And PAPA, the Psoriatic Arthritis Patient Alliance, once again have a fantastically helpful website.